Hi,
this is Take Charge Your Health with Corinne Fornari, clinical nutritionist, clinician assistant, and Carol Peterson, pharmacist. Listen, learn, and I hope you enjoy the show. Bye.
Welcome back. This is Take Charge of Your Health with Corinne Fornari, clinical nutritionist and physician assistant, and my co-host, Carol Peterson, pharmacist. Every week, we present you with new and creative ways to help you make sense of health information. With years of clinical experience between us, we give you practical information to help you take charge of your health. Welcome back, welcome back. I'm here with my co-host,
Carol Peterson.
And we got another one of those very special shows. Actually, it's particularly interesting because this is a topic I thought, you know, I really know this topic. Why do we want to go over this again? And we've shared it with you multiple times because it's an important topic. And then I started to do a little studying, and boy, was I blown away. I learned so much. So take out your pens and pencils, because there's a lot to learn here that will influence your health, your family's health. Carol, would you introduce Jeff Bowles for us?
I'd be delighted to. I came across Jeff Bowles' work many years ago. And one of his first, or maybe the first book that he wrote was on vitamin D. He's an author that had to wait for ebooks to arrive so he could have that format. It was incredible because Jeff really depends on research, and he researches the research. So he comes from a medical family, although he chose not to be an MD himself. So for the rest of his time, he spends a lot of time at Northwestern University researching the research, trying to find whether the research that we've already done supports it or doesn't support it. So it's quite miraculous. He's written on vitamin D. He's written on melatonin. He's written about our death hormones. I hope we'll get into this. So I'd like to welcome Jeff to our show. Perhaps we should start with vitamin D. I was so impressed with your book. I immediately loaded up on my vitamin D. So tell us how you got started with the whole situation and the ebook.
I was about 28 years old, 26, 27. I'd done really well in real estate, and I had enough money where I didn't have to really work that hard anymore, or didn't have to work at all. And I kind of asked myself, what am I doing collecting all this money? Are you just going to die someday? So I said, you know what? I think I better spend my life researching, trying to find a cure for aging. And back then, I thought I could do anything. So I kind of started taking classes at UIC, University of Illinois at Chicago. I started off at age 26, taking Bio 101 with all the freshmen.
Mm-hmm.
And so my goal was, like, I had a singular goal, I was taking one class per semester. I always set the curve because I studied everything like triple. I was just looking at everything with the cure, with the focus of how does this relate to aging. So I did that for like 5-6 years, and I was just very close to graduating with a biochem degree. I was in biochem 2, and they were making us memorize these citric acid cycles
mm-hmm.
and Krebs cycles, and I'm just like, I am not learning anything useful. I said, that's it, I quit. And I dropped out just before getting my biochem degree, and then I decided I'm going to go over to the Northwestern Med School Library and just sit in there and read all the journal articles and books, anything related to aging. So I did that for like 10 years, you know, just nonstop, 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. I always do overdo things. And
yes.
and,
yes.
so, So then I'm looking at these, I'm comparing these two rapid aging diseases. One is called progeria, where those little kids turn into grandparents by the age of 12 and they're dead mm-hmm. by 13. And I'm comparing the symptoms of their disease to the symptoms of Werner syndrome. That's rapid aging that kicks in at puberty. And by the time someone's like 40, they look like they're almost 90. So that's another rapid aging disease. And then I looked, comparing the two cell types, and I noticed the DNA was all scrambled and frayed in the progeria kids. And I go, that's it. That was like my moment of eureka. I had it. I knew what caused aging. So then I started writing. I wrote this big, long paper about, maybe like 70, 80 pages, and I didn't know anything back then. First thing I submitted it to was Lancet, the British Medical Journal.
Oh, they must have really appreciated that.
Well, and the funny thing is I was so excited that I sent it by fax to them, 70 pages. And the guy wrote back and he said, don't ever do this, bother us again. You sent a 70-page fax on press day when they were trying to fax stuff out. And my 70-page paper just kept coming in. And then I submitted it to Nature. They rejected it. And then I submitted it to Experimental Gerontology. And I never read any theory about aging. I just was only looking at the facts. And I just assumed that aging was programmed. It was designed to kill you at a certain age. And I just thought, that's the way it is. My dog gets old when he's 14. It's got to be programmed. And, I'm still young at 14, can't even drink beer. And I've sent the paper to the Experimental Gerontology. That was like the number one aging medical journal. And I got a letter back from Leonard Hayflick, he discovered the Hayflick limit of like mm-hmm. cells can only divide 40 mm-hmm. times. Mm-hmm. They named it after him. He wrote me a 3-page handwritten letter saying, you don't know the first thing about age. it's not programmed. It's random. It's random DNA damage. Everyone knows that you can't select. Evolution could never select for anything that's bad for you. And aging, in the mainstream evolution theory, theorist's mind or aging, theorists, they all start off with the idea of the selfish gene, and the only way evolution works is it just wants to make more and more copies of itself.
Right.
So aging could never be selected for because it's bad for you. Mm-hmm. So they always thought it was just like an accidental artifact of living too long. And I go, that's absolute nonsense. And then I started writing up. I would look through I read his book, and I went through every page and wrote down every error that he made, and I just started harassing him. And he's like, so I didn't get it published there. And I finally sent it to Medical Hypotheses. It was still 70 pages long, and their limit was 10 pages.
Mm-hmm.
But they had like 5 Nobel Prizes won by their editorial board. By the time I had submitted to them, they had a bunch of Nobel Prize winners, including Linus Pauling was one of their editors.
Mm-hmm.
And then several, knighted by the Queen, Sir Karl Popper, Sir James Black, Sir this and that. They said, we will publish your paper as is, and we're going to accelerate it because we think it's extremely exciting and of major importance. And normally, it takes like a year and a half or 2 years to get it published there,
mm-hmm.
and they put mine in right away. So that was the beginning of my, at least my interaction with scientists.
Well, that's amazing.
I got like hundreds of paper requests from all over the world. The paper was titled "The Evolution of Aging: A New Approach to an Old Problem of Biology," and so that's how I got started. And I basically figured out that there's hormones in us that are involved in reproduction, like follicle-stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone. That's what controls the woman's menstrual cycle, the FSH, the follicle stimulating hormone, that causes the eggs to like ripen, and then they form like a little pimple on the on the ovary, and then the luteinizing hormone goes in and attacks the pimple and kills off those cells so that the egg is released. And then I figured out that after age 50, those hormones in both men and women go up like 1,000%, and they're actually driving the aging process that's designed to kill you. It also drives menopause. Yeah, and that was 20 years ago, and interestingly, just about a week ago, a paper came out from some Stanford researchers. They've been researching like why when you hook up an old rat to a young rat, the old rat is rejuvenated. They hook up their blood systems.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes the young rat get old. And so they've been studying these proteins in the cell and which ones go up and which ones go down that cause this effect. The top three proteins they just discovered that go up and cause aging, they're all related to FSH and LH, and also human chorionic gonadotropin. So I've been vindicated after 20 years of laughter.
Wow.
Okay.
And then, can you...
I just had a drink of water. So another prediction I made in that 1998 paper was that luteinized hormone would be found to be a cause of Alzheimer's disease. And that got a lot of chuckles. But I figured out, I found studies that people that smoke, I think it's only women that smoke, and people that take ibuprofen, it suppresses luteinizing hormone, but it also keeps them from getting Alzheimer's. So they tend to have less Alzheimer's, people who take a lot of ibuprofen or women who smoke. And so I said, that's it. That was one of the eureka moments also. And I predicted that would be found to be true. And about 7 years later, a paper came out of the National Institute of Health, and they found that gonadotropins, which is another word for LH and FSH, were found to be highly involved in neurodegeneration. So that was another vindication.
Can I?
I made a bunch of predictions in that paper that came true. Another one was I was the first one to predict that epigenetics would be found to control aging. That's the little proteins and bumps on your DNA that prevent certain genes from being expressed, and then when you get older, you lose these methyl groups, and then these bad genes are expressed, and then the aging occurs. So I predicted that back in 98, and then it wasn't until 2012 a guy from Stanford named Rando wrote a paper, epigenetics controls aging. So, I've been ahead of the curve for a few decades.
Well, you're at
and that's how I got started. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So I want to interject here because I'm all about hormones, bioidentical hormones. I've been working with this for over 28 years. So I already know that LH goes up in absence of enough progesterone and testosterone. I think it would be critical that people get these lab values and look at those two hormones. You already mentioned ibuprofen. And anything else we can do to control excessive LH and FSH?
Oh, of course. So while there's some hormones that go up to kill you, another thing that's bad for you is right around that same time is that these hormones that are good for you, they decline dramatically around age 50. Like melatonin, that suppresses LH and FSH. And it's made at night when you sleep, and it's really high in kids and young people. And by the time you're like 50 or 60, it's dropped down to like the nighttime peaks have like declined by like 90%. And this melatonin drop, I mean, the melatonin controls a lot of your other hormones. Like if you take melatonin, it causes you to make more progesterone in both men and women. I tested my own progesterone before and after I took high doses of melatonin for a while, and my progesterone shot up to like two times over the reference range for men.
Mm-hmm.
So the melatonin had boosted my progesterone levels. And I think that's what's really protecting against Alzheimer's. I mean, the melatonin causes you to make progesterone. And that's supposedly the most neuroprotective hormone on the planet, or substance on the planet. It protects your nerves. And that decline, progesterone declines almost to zero in women, like during menopause, even before the estrogen crashes way down, the progesterone goes down to zero. And that another interesting fact that I learned about that was men get ALS at like mm-hmm. four times the rate of women. That's where your nerves start self-destructing in various,
right.
Yeah, all over your body, and it's fatal within 2 to 4 years usually. And so I was studying that for a lady who wanted me to find a cure for ALS. I bragged that I could find a cure for any disease in 30 days or less just by using the PubMed database. Mm-hmm. So I decided I got to make good on this brag in that book. So I was reading through there's 14,000 abstracts that mentioned the disease ALS, and I'm starting to read every one of them, and starting from the first one, and I got through about 7,000 of them. Oh, like maybe at 3,000, I saw this one abstract that said ALS hits men 4 to 1 compared to women, but when women reach menopause or age 60, the ratio goes down to 1 to 1.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, what hormone is doing? I didn't think much about it, but then I saw it like a second time around the 7,000th abstract. And I saw it again. I go, wait a minute. That's got to be progesterone. Yeah, so their progesterone crashes in menopause, and then all of a sudden, women have like 10 times the progesterone of men throughout their lives.
Yep.
And then around menopause, it drops to about zero, and that's when their ALS ratio goes 1 to 1 to men. I go, progesterone should probably be a good treatment for ALS. And then like a year after I published a book like, with the title ALS Solved, or the ALS Puzzle Solved with a question mark, how two off-the-shelf hormones might be a cure for ALS. And so I put that out on Amazon. It was just kind of a rehash of all my emails with this lady and all my research after I talked to her. It was saying that people should try progesterone for ALS. And then a year after that book went out, some Korean researchers published a paper. They said they injected male mice with progesterone at various doses, 2, 4, and 8 milligrams per kilogram, and they found it only worked for the 4 milligrams per kilogram, but it increased their lifespans with ALS, a mouse version of ALS, from 2 to 4 years up to like 18 years.
Wow.
So the progesterone worked in mice in treating ALS.
I feel like taking a break and having some progesterone.
Yeah. I have a quick question. You also said HCG. How does that fit in human chorionic gonadotropic hormone? And that's a hormone that's released by the placenta when women are pregnant.
Yeah.
But males have it also. Where does it come from in males?
I think it's made in like the lytic cells or something. I don't know.
Uh-huh.
But they do have it. I didn't do
in
a
low
deep
doses.
Dive into that.
Uh-huh.
But I did find one study. HCG is very similar to luteinizing hormone. In fact, sometimes they call some receptors accept both luteinizing hormone or HCG.
Uh-huh.
And they're almost identical. And I was looking at it, I think that's got to be involved in aging, too. And I couldn't find anything about it or anything about HCG levels in men until I finally came across this one obscure paper from Norway or something. And it's in that book of mine. I put that in there. But it turns out that after age 50, in both men and women, their HCG levels go up like 500%. So it's another aging hormone that does the same thing as luteinizing hormone for the most part.
Anti-aging.
As far
it goes as anti-aging? It becomes an anti.
No, it's aging. It's bad for you, just like LH.
I've seen it used with males, and what you see is their hormones go up. They feel more vibrant. Their testosterone goes up. Across the board, their hormones go up.
Right. People use it to boost their testosterone levels. So it's like an outlawed drug for baseball, the HCG hormone. But you know, it's at a lower level, but they're probably aging themselves at the same time their hormones go up. Now, another thing I found out about these hormones, LH, FSH, and HCG is, well, not, I don't know about HCG, but LH and FSH, there's studies that show the pituitary synthesizes those in the absence of testosterone and probably progesterone, any other steroid hormone. But they did the study with testosterone, and estrogen.
Yeah.
When they're synthesized in the absence of those hormones, these the LH and FSH molecules, which are huge to begin with, they become even bigger, and they have a much longer half-life, and they become much more bioactive. So the actual effect of the hormone can change, and I believe it's once they're synthesized in the absence of these, or in the presence of very low levels of the steroid hormones that are good for you and decline with age, then these hormones become like more toxic is one way to look at it. So basically your steroid hormones drop quite a bit, like DHEA. There's other hormones that decline with age that are good for you, like DHEA, progesterone, pregnenolone, testosterone. So these are all programmed to decline quite a bit, and then that leads to more poisonous forms of the LH and FSH that kill you.
So
you all probably have
your hormones.
And how does melatonin fit into that? I know it's a muter or a balancer of estrogens, but
well, melatonin's a real good anti-aging hormone. It kind of controls a lot of your other hormones. It like suppresses the bad ones, LH, FSH. I know it makes your progesterone go up. It probably makes your DHEA go up. It's kind of like the conductor of most of your reproductive hormones. In fact, in Europe, they gave women 75 milligrams of melatonin at night, and that served as a perfect form of birth control. Because I guess it suppresses their LH and FSH enough where they can't get pregnant. Some other people have experimented with giving melatonin to women that have just started going into menopause,
mm-hmm.
and it reverses the menopause, and they start ovulating and menstruating again.
At what dose?
I think it was a low dose for menopause reversal, but
mm-hmm.
if you ask me, in my theories, the one thing I've discovered was whatever drives the reproduction process hormonally is also going to be involved with the aging process also, like later on in life. They're like two sides of the same coin. I would believe that if you want the best anti-aging effects from melatonin, you'd want to take enough where it's causing birth control in women. Because that's another thing, is caloric restriction causes mice to live like 40% longer when they're almost starving to death. You know about
mm-hmm.
that, right?
Yeah.
And the hormone changes that occur is melatonin shoots up dramatically, and a lot of other hormones get suppressed, like luteinizing hormone, FSH. It also suppresses testosterone, but it boosts DHEA the same amount as testosterone goes down. And DHEA is similar to testosterone without some of the masculinizing effects of testosterone. So it's kind of like the non-reproductive form of testosterone. But that's in my 1998 paper. So basically, melatonin is the caloric restriction hormone. So it's controlling all your other hormones at high levels, slow the aging process, or even rejuvenate you. And the evolutionary theory behind that is, so let's say we've all species has survived many famines and droughts, and the way it's done, I believe, is... the species that survive have a system where when there's no food around, they start starving, the melatonin goes up, that inhibits reproduction because you don't want to have children in a famine, because then the mother and child are more likely to starve than if it's just the mother trying to survive. And then if it's going to be a long drought or famine, evolution wants to keep you reproductively fertile so that once this long famine is over, there's at least still a few individuals young enough to reproduce. Species with this particular system survived, and the species that didn't have this system, they all went extinct, you know, in famines. And the same thing happens with droughts. So you can actually starve animals of water. If you dehydrate them enough, you also get, like, large increases in melatonin and big increases in lifespan. I created the longest living rat by restricting their water. I started with young rats. I would give them dried Dorito corn chips to eat, and then dehydrated food. I wouldn't give them any water. I keep weighing them. They were like 50 grams. I'd weigh them until they got down to 40 grams, and then I'd let them drink as much as they could until their weight went back up to 50. And I found over time that they could go like 10, 12, 13 days without water. And then I'd give them water until their weight went back up. And then if they started looking a little unhealthy, then I'd let them gain like 10 more grams. And then I'd start the dehydration process again. And by doing that through their whole lives, I got one rat to live like 47 months, almost 4 years. And the control rats, I did all this experiment at home in my closet. The control rats, I had eight of them. They died off at an average age of 23, and the oldest one was like 26, 27 months. And I only had two water-restricted rats, and one lived 32 months, and the other one lived 47 months. And they were sprayed all the females, and I looked up all these. They used them in a lot of caloric restriction experiments with thousands of rats. Mm-hmm. And I looked up the longest lifespan for any Sprague Dawley female, and my one water restricted rat that lived 47 months lived longer than any of these rats in all these studies with thousands of rats.
Amazing!
So I created the longest living rat in at least of that breed.
That's amazing. But I would like to go
water restricted fasting diets out there. So people are incorporating some of that philosophy to restrict.
Oh yeah, I used to run into people from the Caloric Restriction Society. They're like people that they get like down to 120 pounds and they complain that they're cold all the time. And
that sounds fun.
You don't have to do that. You can just take melatonin.
Now, I want to go back and start at the beginning again. This has been so interesting, and I've been learning so much, but I wanted to talk about your first book, as I understand it, Vitamin D. Now, we talk about vitamin D all the time on this program, almost ad nauseum, don't we, Carol? But the information that you shared and that you have on vitamin D knocked my socks off, as they say. And I'd like to go over some of that and how it relates, how vitamin D, how it very specifically relates to our immunity and our immune system, because I don't think people get the relevance of vitamin D. I mean, our officials, they tell us to wash our hands and wear masks, and we find out that Fauci's taking high doses of vitamin D daily. We find out that Trump took 50,000 international...
Every other day, yeah.
Every other day, 50,000, that's 25,000 a day when he was in the hospital. So really, what did he get better from? So I want to talk about vitamin D. And what we can do in our homes, you know, we've been taught to be afraid of vitamin D. Oh, too much. It's really toxic. Maybe you can help us out. Let's stair-step our way through vitamin D, if you don't mind.
All right. Well, first I'll have to expose the conspiracy that's been going on since the 1920s with a quick little story. Casimir Funk, the father of all our vitamins, they discovered vitamin D in the 1920s, and they called it the sunshine hormone. It's actually not a vitamin. It's a hormone that controls at least 2,700 genes by my count involved with your immune system. You make it in your skin when you sit in the sun, but you can only make it in the summer sun. Like if you're north of Memphis, you don't make any vitamin D from the sun for like 6 months out of the year. The bottom line is in the 1920s, people started taking, like, they were putting D3 or vitamin D in hot dogs and beer. You can shine ultraviolet light on mushrooms and milk, and it causes, like, a lot of these things to increase their D3 content. And so people started taking vitamin D pills in the 1920s, like 25 milligrams. At the same time, Rockefeller was looking for a new use of his oil because his kerosene business was put out of business with the electric light bulb. He had all this oil, and the cars hadn't come along yet. So the Rockefeller was giving money to all these med schools that you can have all this money, but you have to start teaching medicine the way we want. And his goal was so he's going to start making various drugs from oil, and that was going to be how he was going to make money. Again, with this oil. In the meantime, in the 20s, they started building all these hospitals because they're going to turn it into a big business and take medicine out of the home and have them go into these hospitals. And we were way over-bedded as far as hospital beds go. I mean, in hospitals, we have way more beds per person than we do now in the 1920s. So they're all waiting for these sick people to fill up the hospitals. But everyone's, the vitamin D craze, everyone's taking 25 milligrams a day. Are up to, and nobody's getting sick, and the hospitals were empty, and this whole thing was going to go bankrupt. And guess what they did? The powers that be in medicine, instead of being happy about this, they did some experiments giving like really high doses, like possibly with impurities in it, to dogs and horses, and they could get them to die, you know, in some cases. They're trying to make it sound like vitamin D was dangerous. And then 25 milligrams all of a sudden became 1 million international units. And then they started telling everyone, don't take more than 400 IUs a day because it's dangerous. It's toxic. Mm-hmm. And 400 was just enough to keep little kids from getting bow legs called rickets. And that was just enough where kids wouldn't get rickets. And that's, you know, that certainly wasn't optimal for health, but since then they've been, oh, God, until just like 6-7 years ago, they're still saying don't take more than 400. Now they're saying, oh, 800's okay. And now they're like, oh, 2,000's okay to some doctors. But it turns out it's ridiculous because you make D3 and when you sit in the sun, and these high numbers are meant to scare you away, and because vitamin D3 is really bad for business, for the medical industry, and big pharma. If everyone started taking 20,000 a day, it would wipe out 90% of the medical industry and most of big pharma. I know that's a crazy statement, but it's true. That's why they're so hostile to vitamin D3, and they try to keep it secret. So Fauci knows about it, and he takes 7,000 a day, but he doesn't mention it to anybody. They've got to keep it secret, or they're all going to go out of business. And in fact, they're pumping out junk science out of Harvard. There's a thing called the Vital Study, and they've rounded up 25,000 people to take 2,000 units a day, and then they say, well, does it cure prevent cancer or heart disease? And they find, oh, it doesn't work. So they tested on all these diseases, and they keep saying, oh, it doesn't work for this, it doesn't work for that. And I sent an email to the head of that study. I just said, you know, quit pumping out junk science and do the right thing, and just start using 20,000 a day, and you'll see a big difference. And she's like, be careful what you wish for. Her name's Joanne Manson. And
I know her name well. And
yeah. So she's like part of
initiative. person.
She's part of the big pharma conspiracy to put a lid on this D3 stuff. But it's really ridiculous because all you got to do, if you go out and sunbathe for a half hour at the Canadian-U.S. border in the summer, your skin's going to make 20,000 units of D3. So, I mean...
20,000 units every hour?
In a half hour.
In a half hour. That's what I thought. So yeah, we're looking at
an hour,
5 hours?
Yeah, an hour of sunbathing.
Uh-huh.
An hour of sunbathing is like 50,000 units almost.
50,000 units. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Now, what does D do to our immune system? How does D... Yes.
Well, here, that's interesting. I've just been studying that recently because I couldn't understand some of the death and new case charts over the time for COVID-19, but I finally figured it out. Your thymus, it's a gland in your neck. It makes killer T cells. They're known as the CD8 cells. And that's your number one first line of defense against viruses and cancer cells and this and that. That is a very effective immune system if it's working properly. When it's working properly, as soon as there's a virus-infected cell in your body, these killer T cells go up to the infected cell and they figure out what this thing is and they kill that cell within 90 minutes. And you don't really get sick. You don't even have any symptoms. You might feel sick for, like a half hour. That's probably the people that aren't getting sick from D3 have a well-functioning killer T cell system. And what happens when it touches the infected cell, all of a sudden these vitamin D3 receptors pop out of the killer T cell. And if there's D3 around, that binds to those receptors. And what's weird about these cells is they also have proteins on them that will convert the regular vitamin D3 into the active form that regulates the 500 genes inside the killer T cell that have to function properly to kill off these virus-infected cells. Basically, now if you take D3 orally and you want active D3 throughout your body, it first has to be processed in your kidneys and then your liver, and it's a longer process. It's a number of days. But these killer T cells can take D3 and just turn it right into the active form. And then, but if that D3 is not around and your killer T cell system's not working, then those virus-infected cells are going to keep pumping out virus and they're going to live. And then you've got a backup system, which is called the B cell, that your thymus also makes B cells. And those are cells that they grab a hold of like a virus particle and take it into your bone marrow. And then they also have vitamin D receptors on them that need to be activated. And it goes into your marrow, and then these B cells in your marrow, they start pumping out antibodies. And so, but that takes 5 to 30 days. So if you're relying on your B cell immune system to kill off the virus, you're going to get like bad symptoms for anywhere from 5 to 30 days before it figures out the right kind of antibodies to make to knock out the virus. And then if that's not working well or it's too slow, then it's a race between your slow immune system and the virus replicating. And if the virus wins, you die. That's how vitamin D affects your immune system. And I have ideas, like from an evolutionary point of view, why it does it, which we can go into at another time if you want to. I call it the human hibernation syndrome.
Now, vitamin D, you're talking about vitamin D as a pivotal component of our immune system and our resistance. Okay?
Yes.
Now, what level do we want to be at? When I started checking vitamin D, the lower limit was 7, and the upper limit was like 30 or 40. Now we're where do we want to go?
30 to 100.
30 to 100.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So they've come up with a reference range of what they call normal in the United States. it's 30 nanograms per milliliter on the low side and then 100 on the high side. I think like about 95% of the population falls within those within that range. And because they're testing people like in North America, so they say, oh, well, that's the healthy range because it's normal. But what they fail to mention is they're testing a, basically a vitamin D3 deficient population just based on, just by definition, we're D3 deficient because you move north of the 30, you move north of the Tropic of Cancer, and then if you're dark-skinned, if you migrate here and you're dark-skinned, over time, evolution turns everybody white, once you get north. And that's just because it turns out the darker-skinned people, they make less D3 in their skin because it takes like five times more sun to make D3 in like a black person versus a white person. Mm-hmm. And so they die from all these diseases associated with D3 deficiency at a higher rate than lighter-skinned people. So over time, if we stopped any immigration into North America from dark-skinned people, that, like, I don't know how long it would take, maybe 1,000 years, everyone would turn white eventually because the white people can make the D3 much faster in the weaker sun. So it turns out, so the 30 to 100 might just be a... That all might be a deficiency. I mean, everyone in that range could be deficient. I have found there was a German doctor who read my book, and he wrote his own book. He's an ophthalmologist, and he claims that he's been testing stuff on his patients, and he found that they don't get cures from diseases or issues until their blood levels are 125 or higher.
That's so interesting.
If you're and 125 is the same amount that if they test like a lifeguard at a Florida beach in the summer, that they often test at 125. So no. It sounds scary. The doctors will say, "Stop it! It's toxic." But
I just experienced that. I had a test and I tested at 120, and the laboratory guy sends me a paper, and the paper was saying high vitamin D levels suppress your immune system. I think I sent
Well, it actually, it's true. It suppresses one part of your immune system, but it revs up another part. It basically suppresses the parts that attack your good tissues. So it you can cure any autoimmune disease with high-dose vitamin D3. There's a Dr. Coimbra who's doing that. You look up Dr. Coimbra protocol. He's cured more than 100,000 MS patients, and there's all these Facebook groups with the Coimbra protocol, and he has the patients take 1,000 units of D3 per kilogram of body weight. So like a normal man might have to take 80,000 a day, and it cures your MS in about 6 months. So that's a lot better than these big pharma drugs. And it's cured. He's cured rheumatoid arthritis. And on my website, I've got a search engine where you can pop any disease in there. I've been taking notes from more than 1,000 people who have reported to me about their case studies, self-reported case studies of taking of high dose D3 experiments of the last 8 years. If you pop in vitiligo in my search engine at jefftbowles.com, that's B-O-W-L-E-S, there's a search engine. You can just pop in the term vitiligo, and all of a sudden it'll pop some of Coimbra's before and after pictures will show up, like people that take 35,000 units of D3 a day, their vitiligo goes away in 6 weeks.
Wow.
It cures psoriasis. He's got all these before and after pictures. It shows MS lesions in the brain going away in 6 months. He's been onto it, but the bottom line is, yes, it does suppress one part of the immune system It's the killer T cells that are they can't see well when their D3 levels are low. There's 500 genes in those cells that need to be working properly to ignore good tissue and then attack the bad actors like cancer, viruses, fungal infections. So once you get your D3 levels up, it's basically like a good pair of glasses on your immune system. They can see properly, and they'll attack the bad stuff and leave the good stuff alone.
Now, I was listening to one of your lectures, And you stated that there is literally no toxicity for D3. Is that
right,
true?
Right. Yeah, vitamin D3 is completely non-toxic. It's just all it is information to your DNA. D3, I mean, you could, as long as you stop any of the negative effects that your DNA is engaging in, the D3 itself is not poisonous. It's they see that if people take high dose D3, they all of a sudden, some people can get hypercalcemia, mm-hmm. too much calcium in your blood.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not caused by the D3. It's caused because D3 at high doses, it uses up its 5 cofactors doing its work. One of the cofactors is vitamin K2, and that's a vitamin that charges up a hormone that takes calcium out of your blood and puts it back into your bones. And if you take too much D3 and all of a sudden you deplete your K2, then the calcium's not going to go back into your bones, and it stays in your blood. And that hormone can actually work in reverse, the one that K2 affects, called osteocalcin. And so it can take calcium out of your bones and put it into your blood. So if you're taking K2 with the D3, you don't have to worry about that. And then another negative effect of high-dose D3, it eats up your magnesium like crazy. And about 80% of us are already magnesium deficient because the soils are all depleted. They've been depleted for centuries, so our food supply is magnesium deficient. Doctors don't have a test for that. They test your blood serum, and that's tightly controlled, and it never varies much, and it only contains 1% of your magnesium. 99% is in your tissues in your body. The only way to find out if you're magnesium deficient is to get like a muscle biopsy. So the blood test tells you nothing. So the doctors don't test for it. And so when they give people high dose D3, they get like sometimes they get immediate negative symptoms like dizziness and falls. You can get heart palpitations, panic attacks. In extreme cases, hallucinations and seizures. What else? Muscle cramps, photophobia, all sorts of weird mental issues. But those are all just symptoms of aggravating an underlying magnesium deficiency. So that's what D3 can do. But the doctors don't know this, and they think, oh, D3 is causing all this stuff, but it's not. It's eating up your magnesium. It's using it for repair purposes, and then all of a sudden you're getting magnesium deficiency symptoms. And I would say, basically, vitamin D3 deficiency causes about 75% of the illnesses out there. Probably magnesium makes up most of the other 25% magnesium deficiency symptoms.
Now,
but you wipe out those two. Yeah, you wipe out those two deficiencies, and the doctors are out of business.
Whoa, there's something that I want to get in because we're coming to the end, and this just knocked my socks off. I had to listen to it and listen to it and listen to it again. And this was the relationship. Well, first of all, the study in Spain showing vitamin D with high vitamin D levels, there were no deaths, there was reduced hospital time, and only one patient of the whole study with the higher vitamin D levels was put in the ICU, but then came out. So that was pretty...
That was that COVID-19 study in
exactly.
Spain where they they had 50 people got 100,000 vitamin D3 up front, and then 50,000 twice a week, or almost every other day. And out of the 50, nobody died. These are all people who are admitted to this hospital for COVID-19. Nobody died, and only one of them went to the ICU. The other group was 26 people. They didn't get the D3, and 13 of them died. I don't know, 13 of them went to the ICU. And two of them died. So if you're going to get COVID-19, if you start at the first sign of illness, if you feel like a cold coming on, just start taking 50,000 a day until you feel better.
I have
pretty much what Trump That's what Trump did.
Exactly.
That was his miracle cure.
Exactly. Now, I have one other thing that I want to get in. Black people die at a 5 times higher rate from this virus than white people. And you have a very distinct opinion about that. Could you explain that to us and we in 3 minutes or less? Oh, yay.
Oh, well, it's real simple. The black skin takes like 5 times more sun to make vitamin D3, the same amount of D3 as white skin. So like they're in the sun for 1 hour, they're going to have 1/5 the D3 that white people make from it. And that's why they die from COVID-19 at 5 times the rate of whites. And the weird thing is that relationship holds true in Detroit, Milwaukee, St. Louis, Chicago, New Orleans. But when you get down into Florida, the blacks and the whites are dying at about the same rate. So the question is why? And the reason is that once you get down into those lower latitudes, like near Key West is right by the Tropic of Cancer, so that's almost tropical. The sun is much stronger. It's just enough to keep their D3 levels high enough above that critical level where they don't die. And then the white people are probably dying at a little higher rate because there's a large number of elderly in Florida. And they did a study, the elderly skin makes less than 50% of the vitamin D3 that young skin does when exposed to the sun.
Wow. My mind is blown, I must tell you. My mind is blown.
Oh, and then they got all those people with all those comorbidity diseases.
Yes.
You know, like asthma or obesity, this and that. Yeah. All those diseases that they say are risk factors. They're all caused by vitamin D3 deficiency.
Asthma?
People are curing their people cure their asthma with high-dose D3. That's another thing we found out. And obesity, you can look at the obesity map of America, and then you can find out, you can superimpose maps of where there's a high African-American population. That explains a lot of obesity. Another part that explains it is Indian reservations. They have skin that's darker. It takes, and then Hispanics. So that explains most of the map of obesity in America, except there's one area that's really obese, and it's white people. It's the Appalachian Mountains. So the question is why? The Appalachian Mountains are about 3,000 feet high, so they're low altitude mountains. They block out enough sun over the year where these white people have vitamin D3 deficiency. Because your D3 levels are basically a slow-moving average of how much sun exposure you've had over the year. So like once you get D3 in your system, it lasts for like a month or two. So as it goes, so it's a real slow-moving curve that goes up and down over the year. And if you have just like enough mountain shadows that are blocking the sun, that adds up, and that gives you D3 deficiency, and that's why you see the obesity there. And the really cool thing in my book that was banned by Amazon, which you can get, I'll give it to you free, if you go to my website, jefftbowles.com, and you can read the first blog post. That gives an email address where I can email you the PDF file of the book. It's banned, so I'm giving it away free to everybody. But the cool, really cool thing in that book, I discovered there's no fat people in Colorado.
No.
And I couldn't figure that out because they're in these mountain shadows. It should, you know, if that's true, then the mountain shadows in Colorado should make everyone really obese, right?
But it's mile high.
Yeah, well, it turns out every 1,000 feet you go up in altitude, the UVB emitted from the sun is 4% stronger.
Oh.
So by the time you're at 10,000 feet high, the sun is 40% stronger. So that's wiping out the reduced sun effect, and that's a better effect than that offsets the negativity of the shadows, reducing your D3. The sun is so strong that they make even more D3, and that's why nobody's fat in Colorado.
They're also very, 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 they're very proud of their physical activity. They're very physically active.
They can be proud of it, but it's all because of the high air.
Mm-hmm. So listen, I want to thank you so much. We would very much like you to come back and talk with us again. We all learned, and I'm sorry, we've come to the end of our hour. It's a heartbreak.
All right. Well, just make sure you go to jefftbowles.com. I've got like 60 different blog posts of different diseases where people have cured themselves with high-dose D3, and so I have all these little articles, and there's a search engine. You can see if your disease can be cured with D3.
We'll also post it.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, post your website. And I've already posted a link to Jeff's book at our Facebook, but if that's not working, go to his website. And our Facebook page is Take Charge of Your Health with Carol and Corinne. Sorry, with Corinne and Carol. And find a link there as well.
Thank you so much. Right. And we hope to have you back soon. Keep up the good work.
I'll be happy to. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Bye.
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 So we'll be back next week. Thank you again. Bye-bye.
Bye.
In conclusion, I'd like to say, remember, this information is not an attempt to diagnose or a substitute for treatment. As always, we urge you to take this and all other information we share with you up with your healthcare practitioner. Clearly, this comes under the category of taking charge of your health. You can hear this program in its entirety on my Facebook, Corinne Fornari, RPA CCN, or on Take Charge of Your Health Facebook page, Take Charge of Your Health. My website is fornarihealth.com. And my office number is 212-219-0700. That's 212-219-0700. And I know many of you noticed that beautiful music, a big change. My brother's group wrote it for me. Left Hook from Redding, California. Really special. Thank you so much for spending this time with us. And we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.